and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Jayatha Richelvam. Last week, the Employment Appeal Tribunal gave us the benefit of its wisdom and binding guidance on the vexed issue of the impact of voluntary overtime performed by employees on the calculation of holiday pay. Joining me on the phone today to discuss the EAT's decision is Nick Cronius, who's a partner with DOC Beechcroft. Hi, Nick.
Good morning, Jaya.
So, to give our listeners some context, 56 council workers brought claims for unlawful deductions of wages in relation to the calculation of their holiday pay. What was their main argument?
Their main argument was that they were entitled to have the payments that they received when they worked out voluntary overtime included in their first 4 weeks of holiday pay as required by the Working Time Directive and as we've implemented through our working time regulations.
And so this case was different because they were trying to get voluntary overtime included.
That's right. So your listeners will know all about the Bear Scotland case. That was a case that concerned contractual overtime where employees were required to work overtime when asked to by their employers, where in this case the individuals could choose whether they worked the overtime or not.
And did the workers have contractual hours?
They did. So they had regular, normal hours of work. And so the challenge they had on the law is that under our law, when it comes to calculating a week's pay for holiday pay under the working time regulations, the law says that you should receive your normal pay where you've got set working hours for those set working hours. But what they were saying was that that wouldn't honour the Working Time Directive principle that everyone should receive their normal remuneration, that is, any payments that are intrinsically linked to their performance of their duties, and if they weren't allowed to include that voluntary overtime in the holiday pay that they received.
So they were saying that despite the fact the overtime was entirely voluntary, that should be included in the calculation of a week's pay.
That's absolutely right.
Whose side did the EAT come down on?
So they came down on in favour of the employees. And the most critical reason that the EAT reached that decision was that, in their view, the law requires that individuals should basically receive, when they're on that first 4 weeks of holiday under the working time regulation, the same pay as they would have received if they had been at work. And so the critical question is, what are they getting paid when they're at work? And basically making sure that that is mirrored when they're on holiday. And if that doesn't happen, then that breaches the law as it's been interpreted in a number of cases, including Bear Scotland and the Williams case as well.
So I suppose the key question that the EAT was trying to answer and the employers should be asking is whether overtime can be properly said to form part of a person's normal pay.
Correct. And that was the nub of the question that they looked at. And what they decided was that in circumstances where these individuals regularly worked overtime once every 4 weeks or once every 5 weeks, the Employment Tribunal had been entitled to find that that was sufficiently predictable and routine that it should fall to be treated as part of their normal pay, and that it didn't actually matter that it wasn't part of their contractual obligation. So the EAT specifically rejected the employer's argument that only payments that are linked to an obligation that the person is required to carry out under their contracts have to be included in normal remuneration.
And the EAT, it also drew a distinction, didn't it, between overtime, like you said, that's normally worked and paid, but also overtime that's exceptional or which is usually unpaid.
That's right, they did. And that is going to be the, I think, key area for debate in the future. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail in a minute. But from case to case, you may get a different answer depending on, I think, three key considerations. First, how predictable the overtime or the other activity is. Second, how regular it is, so how often it happens. And third, how long it has been worked for. And I think those are going to be the three considerations that are going to be argued over in future cases and may depending on the facts of the case, may lead to different decisions than the decision that the EAT reached in this Dudley case.
Okay, so EAT has set down a binding principle, but actually whether or not this principle is applied on a case-by-case basis will depend on those three points that you have just mentioned.
That's right. The EAT has made clear that whether something is normal pay will be fact-sensitive from case to case, but that in this case there was sufficient regularity and predictability about this overtime that they worked that it fell within normal pay.
So this decision was obviously at the EAT level. Is there any scope for it being appealed, or do you think it's going to be appealed?
There is scope for it to be appealed, but as far as I know, having checked, no permission to appeal has been sought yet. And obviously, if it isn't sought, then the decision remains and it's obviously binding on employment tribunals.
Because this is quite a technical case, probably for some of our listeners. So can you tell us what things they should be doing differently when they go away after they've listened to this podcast in terms of just really practical implications and practical things?
Sure. So there are still a number of employers, because of the legal uncertainty that's been created about holiday pay, who've been taking a wait-and-see approach. It's much harder to legally maintain that wait-and-see approach given this decision, because it's very, very clear about the principle that voluntary overtime can and should be included when it forms part of normal pay. So for those employers that operate voluntary overtime arrangements, they need to look at those three elements that I've talked about. For how long have people been working it? How regular is that pattern? And how predictable is it? And if, for example, they're in a situation where they have people who for many months or years have been working, say, 1 week of overtime in every three or 1 week in every four, then I think that in those circumstances, the law is basically saying that they should be including that overtime payment in those 4 weeks of holiday pay, because it will be treated as normal pay. Where employers' circumstances are different, where it is more unpredictable, where voluntary overtime may only just have started, then I think those employers can legitimately say, well, actually, if we monitor it and if that pattern becomes more regular and more predictable and spreads over a greater period of time, then their vulnerability will go up. But if it's something that is a recent situation, or if the pattern is very unpredictable, and if, for example, a person does a week's overtime next week and then doesn't do any for another 2 months and then does a week's overtime a month after that, then that person may well be in a different category. But that's where this fact sensitivity that the AT mentioned comes into the equation.
So if we take that first group of employers who are employing employees who do fairly predictable and regular overtime, so looking forward, they have to take that overtime into account when they're calculating a week's pay for the purposes of holiday pay. In terms of looking back at employers' previous liabilities, where do they stand with that?
So the EAT's decision left untouched the guidance that we have in the Bear Scotland case about time limits, which basically says that the clock is reset where there is 3 months in which the individual has been paid properly. So if, for example, there's a situation where the employee has taken holiday but they've been paid what's due to them, so for example, it relates to the fifth week or the weeks of holiday pay over and above the 4 weeks that are required by the Working Time Directive, or even over and above that which the employer contractually gives, then that would potentially break the chain and the employee would not be able to go back further to make claims that might be historically based in holiday that they took a year or 2 years ago. Alongside that is also the change that was introduced to the working time regulations following the Bear Scotland decision that puts a 2-year backdating limitation on these types of claims as well.
Okay, so we're looking at a time limit of, or a potential liability of period of either 3 months or 2 years, and 3 months is dependent on them having received the correct payment, including which factors in payment for the regular overtime.
Correct.
Okay, that's a really useful summary of the Dudley case. Just staying with holiday pay, though, are there any other elements that we don't have case law on in terms of what holiday pay is made up of?
There are. So the two areas that I haven't seen any case law on are bonuses and on pensions. The pensions, I think, is a particularly complex area on bonuses. My assessment based on the case law that we've got is that the risks for employers could only arise for bonuses that are based on that individual's own performance. So, for example, a bonus that is based on corporate performance or the achievement of a team's financial targets as opposed to an individual's targets would be outside of scope, but there is potential vulnerability that bonus payments that are specifically linked to an individual's performance in his or her role may have to be included. But that's where we're waiting for case law to see what courts and tribunals say.
And did you mention pensions?
I did. And as I said, pensions is a very complex area because the debate is whether, in terms of contributions that have been made into a pension scheme, whether somehow those contributions or the benefits that accrue to employees as a result of those contributions should fall to be included in holiday pay as well. As I said, that's a very untested and complicated area, but there might be some argument in respect of it.
So just revisiting this concept of a week's pay, a week's normal pay, So how does an employer do that? Because obviously in other areas like calculating maximum working hours, we can use a 12-week reference period, but are employers allowed or permitted to use a similar kind of period when we're calculating a normal week's pay?
So that hasn't been definitively dealt with by the courts. Bear Scotland said that the 12-week reference period in the Employment Rights Act section about calculating a week's pay was an appropriate look-back period to use. But there hasn't been anything that has said that it's impermissible to use a longer reference period. And for example, going back to your question about practicalities, I'm certainly aware of some employers that are looking to negotiate or agree longer reference periods, for example, with their recognised trade unions, so that it smooths out effectively peaks and troughs, so that it's both fair to the employer and fair to the employee. So, for example, where there's a predictable surge of activity, where an employee works a substantial amount of overtime, that they don't get a big pay bump if they then take holiday immediately after that. But equally, that if they have a significant period where they haven't worked the overtime, that is smoothed out and some element of that is included if you use a longer reference period. So I'm aware of that, but as I said, what hasn't been tested is the legality of that at the moment. The Bear Scotland case says we think 12 weeks is appropriate, but it certainly doesn't say, and no other reference period is appropriate.
Thank you. That's a really useful look at that area of the law. Obviously, we had the epic decision about the abolition of employment tribunal fees last week. So do you think that's going to open the floodgates in terms of employees pursuing these types of outstanding holiday pay claims?
I think that in the same way as the Supreme Court found that the fees were an impediment to people accessing the employment tribunal system generally, there is obviously a risk that with the removal of the fees, people will be more encouraged and feel more able to bring holiday pay claims. Back when the Bear Scotland decision came out, there was a lot of commentary that suggested that there would be many, many thousands of holiday pay claimants in a way similar to the equal pay cases within the public sector that were a significant facet of the employment tribunal's landscape perhaps about 10 years ago. That didn't happen. And it may be that the fees were a contributing factor to that not happening. And with their removal, that means that people will be more prepared to bring these claims. Obviously, it's very early days yet. I haven't seen any rush of new cases as a result of this. But there is some risk that there will be an increased number of cases on the holiday pay area because of the removal of the fees. Precisely because this is exactly the sort of case, in general terms, not of huge financial value to the individual, so they might say that the nearly £400 of fees that they'd have to spend to bring their unlawful deduction from wages claim is too high a price to pay. Well, they might well think, now that there is no fee, that they should give it a go.
Yeah, and start reassessing what they're going to do about that. And thanks very much, Nick, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So we have a wealth of guidance on the subject on the site, including a case report on the EAT decision in Dudley Council and Willetts and others, and a dedicated section in the Employment Law Manual that deals with holiday pay. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.